The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week, I started a talk around the topic of dukkha, of suffering. And I got about a third of the way through that talk. So I'm going to continue on that theme tonight. I'll just do a little bit of a review of what I talked about last week to kind of give you the context. So this term dukkha, the Pali term dukkha, is usually translated as suffering. It seems to be the most common way the term is translated. But that translation often it's kind of limited in terms of what this state actually is or what this quality actually is. Because when we hear the term suffering, we often think of something kind of major. I mean, if I am in an accident, there's suffering, or you know, if I'm having a breakup in my relationship, there's suffering. But we don't as often realize or think about the kind of everyday, day-to-day, small experiences of tightness and tension and stress as suffering. And this term, dukkha, includes those. The term dukkha, Gill talks about the etymology of that term, the Pali etymology. And the first part of it, the du part of it, basically means bad. And the second part of it, the ka part of it, is something like the empty space for the axle of a wheel. So it's the kind of the hub of a wheel. And so it could be thought of as, you know, a bad wheel, or, you know, a wheel out of round, or a wheel off center, a wheel off kilter. And, you know, that quality of dukkha is just this feeling of just something's not quite right, feeling of that kind of offness of experience. So this is much broader than the term suffering usually conveys. The Buddha talked about three kinds of suffering that really give a sense of this breadth, the kind of breadth or scope of the suffering. And the first kind, the kind that I talked about last week, is the obvious kind of suffering, and it's called dukkha-dukkha. And it is the kind of suffering that we usually don't mistake as anything else. We really recognize this is suffering. And so I talked quite a bit about that last week, ways that it comes up, the kind of way it is often a response to something unpleasant in our experience. That if there's unpleasant physical sensation, there's reactivity and tightness and contraction around it. If there's an unpleasant thing happening in our mind, there's tightness and tension and anger or frustration or irritation. And those experiences are also suffering. So one key piece to notice about this term of suffering, and it's particularly obvious in this dukkha-dukkha area, the suffering of pain or the suffering of unpleasantness, that the suffering aspect isn't about the unpleasant sensation itself. Because we're all going to experience pleasant sensation, unpleasant sensation, neutral sensation, and that's not going to change. Our bodies are designed to do that. You know, the physical body is designed to experience pleasant and unpleasant. And no amount of freedom from, you know, no amount of anything happening in the mind is going to alter that physical, actual aspect, that if there's, you know, if there's a cut in the body, if there's a knife that cuts through the bone, there's going to be painful sensation, unpleasant sensation that results. So what is meant by the suffering or the dukkha-dukkha is the mental reactivity to that unpleasantness. That in a sense that physical unpleasantness is just what's happened. I mean, we get pleasant, unpleasant, neutral phenomenon coming to us, you know, just our flow of experience has, it's not only a flow of sight, sound, smells, tastes, and touch, and things happening in the mind, it's a flow of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It's just this flow, a changing flow, includes a changing flow of that quality of feeling. So that's going to be there no matter what. But it's this, it's a reactivity to that, which is what this dukkha is. So that's that reactivity to the physical unpleasantness, the mental reactivity to that physical unpleasantness is what this dukkha-dukkha is. A more subtle kind of suffering, and this is mostly what I want to talk about tonight, is what's called the suffering due to change. So there's this obvious suffering that happens when we meet something unpleasant in our experience. That's this dukkha-dukkha. And this suffering around change is basically kind of bound up with the pleasantness in our experience. That we experience pleasant phenomenon, and what happens when we experience pleasant phenomenon is that we basically, we like it. You know, we like it, we want it to continue. And the suffering that, there's kind of a suffering inherent in that wanting it to continue. Because of that pleasantness that we have kind of attached to, there is a dissatisfaction that results when that pleasant experience ends. So, for example, we might lose something, and have a this could be a mild kind of suffering result as a result of change, that you know we have there's something that we like that we lose or we break a favorite mug, and there's a feeling of dissatisfaction or of sadness or of loss or some kind of agitation, frustration, annoyance, irritation. So that's a form of dukkha-dukkha, a form of that, because the ending of the pleasant is experienced as unpleasant. And then we react to that. So the reason the ending of the pleasant is experienced as unpleasant is because we were clinging to the pleasant. So that it's the clinging to the pleasant that's the source of this suffering due to change. When pleasant experience changes to unpleasant experience, we will suffer if we've been clinging to that pleasant experience. A stronger version of this might result when, you know, we have a death in our family or some major disaster, you know, our home is destroyed by fire. You know, there's a stronger feeling of suffering because of that sense, you know, this should not be this way. The way it was before when I had my home, that's the way it was supposed to be. So the magnitude of the clinging to our experience, the stronger the clinging to our pleasant experience, the greater the suffering will be. And with something like a home, there's not only a clinging to the possessions in the home, there's a clinging to a sense of security, a sense of identity, There's many pieces that are layered into that. And then the loss of that is very threatening to us. But it's not inherent in the change itself. It's because of the clinging that the suffering results. I'm going to try to make this clear over the course of the evening. So that's one way that this kind of suffering due to change can happen, when we lose something. Another way that we might begin to experience this suffering due to change, and the Pali for this, for those of you who are interested in this kind of thing, is viparinama dukkha. Viparinama. Another way you might notice this is if you are in a situation where you have been watching a family member die. You know, so there's the loss of the family member, but there's also a sense, perhaps, of a beginning of a recognition of, I too am subject to this. And a little bit of unease that develops because we have really faced or beginning to face our own mortality. So that, you know, there's a sense of, you know, that holding to life in a way. It seems like it's a very kind of natural thing, but it does produce an unease to us when we really meet this notion. It can produce an unease for us if when we really meet this notion of, yeah, I'm going to die. You know, this is a fact. One of the few things we can count on in our lives, that we will die. So that kind of unease from really deeply meeting this underlying, inherently impermanent nature of existence. One of my teachers, my Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Utejaniya, he has a kind of a different take on this. It feels like a slightly different take on this kind of dukkha. He calls this kind of dukkha, the dukkha of change, the suffering due to change, to be the dukkha of doing, the suffering of doing. That basically, that we, in order to have pleasant experience, we are endlessly doing things to create pleasant experience. And there's an inherent kind of agitation in that endless doing. There's a poet that spoke to this. I may have read this before in this class, but I'll read it again. It's a lovely poem. It's by Rilke. And we, spectators, always, everywhere, turn towards the world of objects. It fills us. We arrange it. It breaks down. We rearrange it. Then break down ourselves. Who has twisted us around like this so that no matter what we do, we are in the posture of someone going away? So that need to continually keep arranging and arranging and arranging, at some point we realize we can't do it anymore. Or that no matter how much we arrange, it just keeps breaking down and keeps breaking down. And there's just this endless having to fix, to do, to keep our lives in order. To keep trying to find this pleasant experience. This is a very normal thing for us, you know. It's like, why wouldn't I try to put pleasant experience into my life? So the process of this suffering due to change kind of mostly starts from this clinging to some pleasant experience. And from, there's a kind of a place where we believe, there's a way that we believe that pleasant experience is the way things are supposed to be. And that there is some way that we should be able to arrange our lives to have one moment of pleasant experience after another. And that that is what life should be. There should be no unpleasant moments. So when this pleasant experience ends, as it has to, everything in our experience is impermanent. And so when this pleasant experience ends, we suffer because we missed a thing that we had before. Or perhaps we suffer because we feel like we've done something wrong. That's a kind of a trap that we end up in. We believe that things are supposed to be pleasant. So that belief means if it's not pleasant, I must be failing somehow. And that when we move into a place of unpleasantness, it reflects back on us. And we suffer because we have not been able to control the world. So there's kind of a way that this suffering of change is related to, at times, it's related to this identity of being someone who can control the world. And we aren't. I mean, there's no way we can control the world. But we somehow think we should be able to. And when it's proven to us that we can't, we suffer. So partly the way this process works, there's the pleasantness that we experience. And what has happened to us over and over again in our lives is that we've gotten something that we want. We've managed to maneuver the world for a period of time to get something that we want. And when we get it, it feels good. And this happens to us over and over and over again. We get something, it feels good. We don't get something, it feels bad. We get something, it feels good. We don't get it, it feels bad. And we learn from repeated experience, or we think we learn from repeated experience, that the way to a happiness is to get what we want. It's been proven to us over and over again that that is the way to happiness, to get what we want. But if we look at a little more detail in what's actually happening there, there's the process of getting what we want. There's the thing that we want. So the pleasant thing that we want to construct in the world, a relationship, or buying a new car, or having a great party, or whatever, you know, that we have this idea of this thing we want to construct. And there's the wanting. It's not just that thing there. There's this wanting to have it. So there's the pleasant experience out there, and there's this wanting quality. And when we actually start to recognize or pay attention to wanting itself, which we don't actually do very often when we're in the situation of wanting something pleasant, where our mind is in the future thinking about how great it's going to be when we get that pleasant thing. So, you know, we're kind of missing the feeling of wanting itself because we're in the fantasy of having the thing in the future. But if we actually paid attention to that feeling of wanting itself, we would discover that it's not pleasant. Wanting actually inherently feels dissatisfied. That wanting is a quality of feeling dissatisfied, feeling a lack. So there's this aspect when we get something that we want, there's two things that happen. We get that thing, and there's a little bit of pleasantness from having the pleasant thing that we've gotten. And then the wanting has gone away for a short time. So we get these two things. We get this having this pleasant thing and the ending of an unpleasant thing. We get the pleasant and the wanting ends. The ending of something unpleasant is usually experienced as pleasant. So we kind of, in the getting what we want, there's a double hit. We get a double hit of pleasant. We get the thing that we want, and we get the ending of the wanting. Usually we don't notice the ending of the wanting. We're much more focused on, oh, I got this thing. I got it. I figured out how to get it. But I'm going to just put this out there as a proposal for you to explore. And in my own experience, I've seen this to be true, that the vast majority of the pleasantness of the getting what we want has to do with the ending of the wanting. It's not because of the getting of the thing. It's mostly the feeling of satisfaction results mostly because the feeling of dissatisfaction has ended. And it's the ending of the wanting that is the ending of the dissatisfaction. So you can play with this. Sometime you might have some experience of noticing kind of a movement towards putting something pleasant into your life. Something simple, buying a candy bar or something like that, where there's this pleasant thing out there and there's the wanting of it. Turn towards the wanting and see if you can notice what the wanting feels like. And notice what happens, if you can, when the wanting goes away. And sometimes when we turn towards the wanting and we don't act on the thing, often it just gets us into the situation where, we can avoid picking that thing up, but we don't actually, we don't actually get to see the wanting go away sometimes. We might just end up forgetting about the wanting and forgetting about the thing, and then at some point later, you're driving home from the grocery store and you remember, oh yeah, I wanted that candy bar and I didn't pick it up, and well, I don't seem to want it anymore, but I didn't see the wanting go away. So you might not actually notice the wanting go away. And that happens a lot. When you start exploring wanting, you may not actually get to see it go away. But if there's some time you actually get to witness that disappearance of the wanting, it really feels like you've been let out of a vice grip. Because the wanting has such a stickiness to it. It's the wanting itself that is throwing us off balance. And when the wanting ends, the dissatisfaction ends. Can you even imagine that? Think about in your mind, the feeling of wanting something. Imagine wanting something. And then imagine the possibility of not wanting it. Is there a problem if you don't have it, if you don't want it? It's not the way we usually operate. To think in this way. And so this process that we normally engage in of getting what we want, of believing that that's the way to go, about getting what we want, this process actually conditions future wanting. And then we end up wanting to want, finding something to want. You might have noticed this sometime looking through a catalog. Flipping the pages. What can I want in this catalog? And I think, too, that this conditioning process around the wanting is where it's kind of the beginning of addiction. That, initially there's the, for alcoholic addiction, there's the wanting of the pleasant feeling that the alcohol provides. And then, you get the pleasantness of the alcohol, the removing of the wanting, and possibly also the removing of unpleasantness that you were trying to avoid because of the alcohol. And the wanting going away, the satisfaction that has resulted, has conditioned the future of doing that again. You know, that we just that wanting satisfied through that pathway conditions that when we get into that kind of a situation again, it's like, well, that worked last time. I'll try it again. And we begin and get caught on this cycle of wanting. And it traps us. And it's not just addiction. I mean, in a sense, we are all addicted to life. We're all addicted to wanting to have things the way we want them to be. And feeling like that's the way things have to be. So this wanting itself is actually a form of dukkha. You know, the suffering due to change is actually kind of that piece, the suffering due to change, that kind of dukkha, isn't the suffering that results when the pleasant thing ends. That's actually back at dukkha-dukkha. Because when the pleasant thing is ended, we're in an unpleasant experience. And we're reacting to that unpleasant experience to try to fix things and change that unpleasantness. The suffering of the of change is happening actually as the pleasantness is going on. So it's kind of inherent in the clinging to the pleasantness. Now, this isn't to say that there's nothing inherently bad about pleasant experience. I want to make that really clear. The issue is that there's wanting to hold on to it and a belief that it has to be this way. That's what we suffer over. The ending of the pleasant itself is not the cause of our suffering. As we practice looking at how we cling, how we hold on to our pleasant experience, practice begins to expose the impact, the underlying agitation that's there because of the wanting and because of the clinging. That kind of underneath that pleasantness, the pleasantness of the experience is masking the kind of dissatisfaction, the subtle kind of dissatisfaction of the clinging and the wanting. So I kind of mentioned this before, or talked about this before, but in that movement towards wanting something, we are projected forward into the thing that we want, the idea. We're projected into the fantasy of that thing that we think we're going to get and the way the world will be when we have it. And that's a pleasant fantasy. And so that pleasantness of that fantasy in the midst of the wanting, and the wanting creates the fantasy in a way, and because of that fantasy, we miss the suffering of the wanting. And with the clinging, too, there's a kind of an agitation with the clinging around a fear of loss, perhaps. You know, the clinging, we're holding on to it, afraid of losing it. But the pleasantness of the experience itself is masking that subtle kind of fear that is inherent in that holding on to. So we basically miss the kind of subtler level of suffering that's happening when we're experiencing pleasant experience and clinging to it. So it's not a failure for us when things change. This is a kind of a re-shifting of the mind, you know, that we learn as we really get this truth that things change. As we really understand that, we see that it's not a problem. It's not a mistake that things change. It's actually just the way things are. It's the truth of the way things are. And we can start aligning ourselves with that truth. We can start aligning ourselves with the way that things are instead of the way we want them to be. So this dukkha of change, the suffering of change, is not inherent in the change itself. So I want to tell you an example from my own practice around this kind of how this played out in one area of my life. And then I'll open it up for discussion. So we can start to learn how this suffering of clinging, suffering of holding, is actually suffering when the pleasant experience is happening. But it's harder to see. It's hard to see that. So there was one retreat where I began to notice, particularly began to notice the mind telling me I was failing. You're not doing this right, you can't do this, you're no good at this. And then, you know, a few moments later, I would recognize, oh, well, I'm actually mindful right now. Oh, I can do this. I'm really good at this. In fact, I'm great at this. And I began noticing there was this real contrast happening. You know, there was this praising of myself going on, and there was this blaming going on. And I started to recognize that initially the feeling was, well, it's this blaming that's the problem. You know, that's where the suffering is, right? I mean, that's where I really felt like I was suffering. When I was praising myself, that's the way it was supposed to be. You know, that's the truth. You know, I am a good yogi. And it felt good. You know, that's kind of, there was this kind of invigorating quality to that feeling. So initially the exploration was around recognizing when I was telling myself I was a failure. I got really good at recognizing that thought was coming in. And at some point I began to recognize or see that the suffering of that part was actually directly linked to the fact that I was telling myself that I was so great. That the suffering of that I'm a failure would not have even come about if I hadn't had some standard of how great I was supposed to be. And that made me realize I really needed to start to look into that praising aspect. I needed to really notice when I was telling myself I was doing well. Now that was hard. I mean, that really felt like, you know, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. If I have to like let go of that, then where am I? But it's kind of a form of measurement in a way. It's like, you know, we create our own standards through, you know, the conduct we think we need to be, need to have, need to project in the world. And when we don't measure up to that standard, we suffer. So I really discovered that the way that the mind was praising itself was actually a setup. It was a setup for me. And when I really got much more careful around really recognizing, oh, that's praise. And I got playful around it. I mean, I just kind of, you know, just said, oh, there's that praising thing again, you know, doing that praising thing again. And, oh, there's that blaming thing. And it began to be much more balanced, you know, just without the praise, there wasn't the ground for the blame to grow in. It's like that quality of praise was the fertile soil by which I measured myself. And when I didn't measure up, the blame grew. I was a failure. So you might, in noticing perhaps a repeated pattern of suffering, in noticing that side of the suffering that is the dukkha-dukkha, you know, recognizing the place where there's the obvious suffering, if there's some pattern there that's happening, see if there's a flip side to that pattern. So for instance, you know, this feeling of I'm out of control or things are out of control. Is there some time when you are really telling yourself how great you are because things are in control? Or perhaps if you feel like you're successful, are there times when you feel like you're a failure? Is there a kind of a balance between those two? Or I'm weak, I'm strong. So that if you notice a pattern of suffering over something, see if you might notice there's a corresponding opposite pattern that you hadn't even noticed or wouldn't even consider as being a pattern. It's just the way things are supposed to be. It was quite a revelation for me to look at that kind of the flip sides of suffering like that. You know, that when there is this kind of dukkha-dukkha suffering, sometimes it comes out of the ending of something that we had identified with. The identity of being successful, the identity of being in control. So, well, I'm going to let you have some say in things now. What do you have to say? What are your thoughts?
I kept thinking of about when you were talking about the second type of dukkha. Suffering of change. It's even more, I guess it's, I don't know, of course, how it was in the past, but I liken it to with a remote, when you're flipping channels on the TV, you're just...
That's the wanting to want.
Yeah, the wanting to want. And sometimes it's almost, there's a quality of desperation.
And the internet is like that too.
Oh, okay.
You know, the internet is a real trap for this, because it's like, you know, you have at your fingertips instant gratification for what you want to find. and it's so sticky. I mean, it's so easy to get pulled into that. It really feels like an addiction, mm-hmm. You know, that movement.
And well, I think they call it soft addictions, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's true. There are with the internet. It actually is. It's actually a serious thing with some kids and maybe even adults. But that's an interesting place to watch this process happening. You know, if you find yourself caught in the internet, look at what's happening. Oh, there's this feeling of craving, a feeling of, oh, just dissatisfaction. And what can I think of to put into that Google search bar that will make me feel satisfied? What can I think of? It's really, and what happens with that addiction actually is, you know, initially it feels good. You know, initially there's the quality of it feeling like, oh yeah, there's something I want it. Oh, I've got it. Oh, there's something I want it. I've got it. And then over time, when the addiction gets stronger, we start to actually feel the suffering of the wanting. You know, that the suffering of the wanting begins to be more obvious, and then we don't feel like we have control over that. It's like that. Oh, I want it, and I have to have it. You know, and we can't pull back from that. So, you know, that's where it really turns into addiction. That the you know, the wanting feels like it has its own force, its own life, and it's hard to enter in and say, well, no, I'm not going to do that. Yeah.
So it's more difficult with modern life too.
Well, it feels like it. I mean, I didn't have much difficulty with the TV, but boy, that internet is really, it's really seductive. You know, it's, I think, inherently very seductive. And I was watching them do a program at one point on the iPad, you know, that new device by Apple. And this one thing the guy said was something like, "It's such a satisfying experience." And I just, my heart sank, you know, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, it's going to create, because it's such a an easy way to get yet more and more to the internet, it's just going to, I think it's just going to draw people more and more in. So it's, I think it's going to create more addiction. The easier and easier it gets to get to go there. And we're just these virtual, like we're just living in these worlds. We're not really living, we're not living in the world. So to me it feels like, to some extent it does feel like there's more place for that kind of wanting to land. I mean, there's always been place for it to land, but it can happen so quickly now.
Excuse me, and as far as your second point was concerned, shouldn't one strive for excellence?
This is a really interesting place. I mean, that we can have a kind of a direction to our lives and have an aspiration. That's a different, I like using that word as opposed to wanting, you know, an aspiration for excellence or an aspiration for peacefulness. There's a difference between a kind of craving for something and an aspiration for something, in that the aspiration generally is, it's inclining you in a direction, but it's not so much demanding a result and demanding it at a certain time. You know, that it's a more, it doesn't have that stickiness to it. It's much more willing to meet the kind of flow of shifting, changing conditions and adjust the course based on what's happening, rather than trying to adjust the things that are happening based on what thing I want to do. So it's much more receptive, that kind of open-hearted direction towards something. So there's a way to do that, and the whole of our practice unfolds based on something like that. You know, that we wouldn't engage in this practice if there weren't some, you know, inclining of the heart towards peace, towards happiness. And that's very wholesome. So there's a kind of beginning to learn and distinguish between the wanting that has that stickiness to it and the kind of movement of the heart towards peace that isn't so demanding.
So kind of aspiration versus drive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the craving has a kind of a for my way or the highway, you know. It's kind of got that feeling to it. Whereas aspiration is more open to what is the world offering and how to respond skillfully in that situation, to keep inclining myself in the direction that feels most appropriate. And there isn't, you know, there isn't anything inherently wrong with wanting pleasantness. I mean, that wasn't quite worded right. It's there's nothing wrong with the pleasantness and nothing wrong with the movement of the heart in that direction, but it's that demand of, it's got to be that way. And I mean, that's the setup, you know, it's got to be that way. If it's not that way, we're crushed. Like I'm a failure, or the world is a failure. The world has failed me. So it's more receptive. More willing to be with the changing nature. than demanding the changing nature be some other way. I mean, we can't do anything about the changing nature. It's really, you know, when we can really come into alignment with the fact of things as they are, it makes things a lot easier. A lot easier to live our lives if we're not continually fighting things as they are. Yeah, Doug.
I found myself wanting to talk. her point that she raised about striving for excellence, it occurred to me that depends on how you define excellence, in that in our culture, if you buy into our culture's definition of excellence, that very often, particularly in the business world, necessitates a compulsion to the detriment of balance in your life. And if that's the model you buy into, then striving for excellence is not going to be a healthy thing.
I agree with you. I mean, it's hard in that situation to simply have an aspiration towards being president and earning $6 million and having three houses and 10 cars. You know, it's like inherently that has that neediness to it. I mean, the way excellence is defined in our culture is about having things often. It's about having money, power, sex,
It's not so much those objective measures of success, if you will. Okay, it's more, I guess what I'm thinking of, it's more a sense of your value and your sense
your
of being.
Worth, your worth.
Your worth,
yes.
Whether it is a dictate of what other people say, and there's never going to be enough.
That's true. That's a good point. That's another aspect of it, that if we give our sense of what success is to the world to tell us what it is, you're right, that'll probably never be a healthy kind of movement.
Right. So it's like for some people, you know, they can achieve material success in quotes easier than others, and they may be able to achieve some of those things without sacrificing balance in their lives, whereas other people can't. I mean, it's just going to vary from person to person, but what matters is, you know, for the individual, how are you doing it? How are you, how are you maintaining that balance in your life to be able to achieve, you know, things in a way that's not going to disrupt your equanimity and
I agree with you about that piece of, you know, the looking at where the motivation is coming from towards that definition. Is it an internal movement to an aspiration? And I've known people that actually they weren't looking for the success. I mean, they weren't looking for the outer trappings of success, and they're the people that seem to most easily have the success, you know, that they're interested in creating something, or, you know, so it's the process that they're interested in rather than the result. And I think that's more that movement of aspiration, you know, that it's the process. But if it's the result, no matter what the result is, I mean, even if somebody finds it's relatively easy to be successful and earn money. If what you are going for is results and having things in the world, you're also inherently going to not be satisfied, because there's not a way to be satisfied by having things. They always change. The satisfaction that results from having something just doesn't last very long. You know, so you know, if the satisfaction is coming from the sense of, you know, helping the world, of creating a tool or device that helps, you know, diagnose cancer, or, you know, something like that's got a different quality to it than, you know, the happiness that I want needs to come from having things in the world. Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing those points up. Yeah, Robert.
So this wanting that you're talking about, the Pali word for desire, I think, is tanha. Mm-hmm. So is this the desire of tanha the same thing as what you're calling wanting here?
Yes.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And is that desire not linked to the wish to become?
There's one sutta in which that term is actually linked to the wish to become free.
To become free.
Yeah.
So but I'm usually using it in a different way, the wish to become, the wish to self, the wish to
yes.
Identify.
Yes, that is the tanha is the link in the dependent origination which leads to becoming.
Right.
Tanha, upadana, bhava. So craving, clinging, becoming.
So if you are picking up on this wanting and this tanha, is there and you said something that really struck me, was if you actually caught the release of the wanting of the candy bar as it was released, it would be like an insight in a way. Is there an action or an activity or something that the yogi or the meditator can do, or is it just something that happens through observation?
In my experience, it's just something that happens through observation. That if you can hang out with the wanting, at some point you might start to see, you know, I hung out with a particular wanting over the course of several weeks on a retreat, a similar kind of wanting that happened over and over and over again, and I got really familiar with the pattern. When did it begin? When did it end? And, you know, I began to really see the conditions that were leading it to come into being. You know, a person came into my field of vision and I wanted to look at them, and then, you know, they disappeared and the wanting disappeared. You know, so it was very intimately connected to having somebody in my field of vision that I wanted to look at them, and I began to really recognize, wow, you know, when that person goes away, I don't want to look at them anymore. And so I began to really feel the release of that wanting, you know, that and that's actually another place to play with this. I mean, you can, this is an interesting game you can play, because I've noticed that. You know, if I'm driving, like one day I was stopped at a stoplight, and there was a Starbucks over there, and seeing the Starbucks brought up the idea of cafe latte in my mind. That was pleasant, and I wanted a cafe latte. And while I sat at that stoplight, I really was intending. I mean, there was a strong pull to go and drive into that Starbucks and pick up a latte. But I realized, nope, okay, that's just wanting. You know, I'm just going to watch that. And when the light finally turned green and I turned the corner and just drove past it, the wanting disappeared. You know, it's like as soon as I was past the Starbucks, you know, and the Starbucks was out of my field of vision, it wasn't quite as immediate as, I mean, it wasn't quite as obvious as the real releasing, the momentary disappearance of the wanting. But you can begin to see that, you know, with things you want. And oftentimes, it's because you've seen something. And then when that thing goes out of your sight, the wanting really diminishes. And so that's a place to play with it, you know, to begin to start feeling that releasing of the wanting.
So I'm noticing the wanting to do something to make the wanting go away.
That's a trap.
And it's really dukkha. Thank you.
So we need to stop. So thank you.